I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation Cure Master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at Surrey Farms. .com or virginiatraditions.com.
Hi, welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm Linda Palacio, your host here on Heritage Radio Network. And today we are talking about something that might surprise some people. I'm going to ask you out there, who hasn't been on a diet at some point? Well, let me see. Anyone over the age of 35, at least, but probably younger than that. Who hasn't been on a diet? I mean, just think about it. SlimFast, Atkins, Weight Watchers, Nutrisystem, Jenny Craig, South Beach. Just, the list goes on and on. There are programs out there that are begging us to try to lose weight. And yet, as a nation, we are, probably about 70% overweight. And today I have with me Susan Yeager, who is an adjunct instructor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University, and she is the author of the just-published book called The 100-Year Diet, America's Voracious Appetite for Losing Weight. Welcome, Susan.
Hi, Linda. Great to be here.
Yeah, it's true. America has such an appetite for losing weight, and yet we're an obese nation, they tell us.
We are indeed. I mean, think about it. We spend $55 billion a year.
That's billion?
That's billions. Wow. That's billions. You know, as I like to say, more than the gross national product of many small countries. $55 billion. And what do we get for it? We're number one. We're the fattest country in the world.
And you have to ask, how did that happen?
You know, this is something I've been thinking about a great deal for the past 7 years, how it came about. We didn't actually start gaining all this weight, Linda, and we may want to talk about this a bit later, but we didn't start gaining until about 1985. That's when all the bad habits and everything began to catch up to us.
Was that when did we first get those charts about how much, what should we weigh, the BMI? And
Well, BMI started way before that. Actually, that was a Belgian scientist who came up with that in the 1840s. We knew what we should weigh. But the thing is that most Americans fell pretty much into that ideal area. We had weight loss forced upon us long before we were a heavy country. As soon as people started figuring out there's money to be made in getting people to think they're heavy, they started selling us on weight loss diets. Really big weight loss got started in the 60s. That's the 1960s. Mm.
Well, in fact, I do want to step back a little bit because you say the 100-year diet, and certainly dieting goes back a lot longer than 100 years.
Oh, yes.
I mean, in the Renaissance, we had the humerus, and people were eating certain foods for certain parts of their body. And, I mean, we're talking millennia.
Absolutely. I mean, Hippocrates speaks about corpulence, about people who weigh too much. There have always been people who weigh too much, you know, Falstaff and Rubenesque women. We started worrying about weighing too much in America around 1880, but very few people did, really. It was the wealthy, it was the people with time on their hands that dieted, or as they called it at that time, they were banting.
Banting, right. I mean, yeah. I read that particular chapter, and we'll talk about that. Well, actually, corpulence was associated with wealth for a long time.
That's the thing. I mean, if you wait a little too much, I mean, think about the turn of the 20th century. Here's Diamond Jim Brady, wealthy businessman, famous for being a glutton and weighing too much. Well, it showed that he had the money to eat too much. And his girlfriend was Lillian Russell. Again, you know, this famous performer at the time. Big, voluptuous woman. It was thought to be terrific if you had a little flesh on you if you were a woman.
That's right.
It showed that you were fertile. You were good wife material. If you got sick, no antibiotics yet.
That's
you
right.
Know, think
That's
about
right.
that. So if you got sick, you had a few extra pounds, kind of money in the bank. So it wasn't really a particular negative to be a bit heavy. Obese, yes, that was never anything that was looked upon right. particularly favorably.
I mean, you just look back at in art history at paintings, and the men generally were portrayed as slimmer and more fit, but the women, mm-hmm. it was desirable to have, to, mm-hmm. and you say that corpulent body.
A sign of beauty, a sign of fertility, yeah. of mm-hmm. sexiness.
Right. How far we've come
How
from the
far,
emaciated
indeed.
Models we see today, right? Well, you mentioned that in the 1800s, where you sort of start out in your history with Fletcher. And
well, yeah, he came along a little later, around the turn of the century, and he is a very interesting character. I mean, here's this guy, Horace Fletcher, who can't get insurance because he weighs too much. And he doesn't know what to do about this. He becomes obsessed with it. He tries different diets. How many of us have done this? Nothing works for him. And then he comes across some literature about chewing, masticating, chewing your food numerous, numerous times, and you will lose weight. And he does this, and it works for him. Why does it work? Well, there are a variety of reasons. One is, if you slow down eating to that extent, you probably will eat less.
Right.
It's going to become boring. Who wants to chew everything 100 times? He printed little cards as to how
so we got the term Fletcherized. People
yeah.
would make Fletcherized.
They called him the great masticator. They called him the choo-choo man. But I love this. This really caught on in America, chewing your food 100 times. I don't like to say ever, you know, as an historian, everyone did something, but it was pretty close. I mean, the middle class was doing it, the wealthy were doing it, the prisoners at Sing Sing were doing it.
Oh, my goodness.
Everyone was chewing. Rich people, society people, would get together and have what they called munchions, not luncheons, but munchions, and they would have these bowls under them, and they would take their food. Now, this was the rich, you know, the rich people, eccentric, right? Poor people would be considered crazy right. if they did this, but they were eccentric. They had their food, and they had someone standing there, and that person would ring a bell, and they would chew and chew and chew and chew and chew at the munchions until he rang a bell again, and then they were allowed to swallow.
Well, I mean, it is known that the brain takes a while. It takes a while for the brain to receive the signals from the stomach that you're full, right?
You are absolutely right. It takes about 20 minutes. Well, if you're Fletcherizing, your brain's going to have a chance to really catch up to that.
Well, I mean, it's a funny story, but it's not a funny situation. And a lot of people will try to attribute our obesity as a nation to processed foods, fast foods, our lack of dining together as a family, of running around too much. I don't think we can really lay blame to any one thing.
Well, because it's all of those things. It's like solving the obesity problem in America today, and it indeed is an epidemic and a serious problem. Diabetes, heart disease, stroke, the psychological ramifications of being obese, so many things, to the healthcare issues, the cost of it. It's a big problem, but it won't be solved by just one thing. It will be solved by many things being done, and a big part of that is education.
Right, and which is what we try to do here at Heritage Radio Network, and bring people back into the world of real food.
Yeah,
which I think is going to make a big difference.
Absolutely.
People.
You mentioned processed food a moment ago, and I think a little earlier said that we didn't start really gaining weight until 1985. Well, why is this? Yes, certain things were catching up to us, the suburbs, fast food, we're driving more, we're doing a lot of things perhaps differently than we did before. But also what happened? I mean, we're subsidizing corn, we're subsidizing soy. High fructose corn syrup is discovered,
mm-hmm.
and it starts getting into everything.
By the
80s, it is allowing soda, which was, let's just look at soda for a moment. You know, we all read about that maybe in the paper this morning.
Well, look at the campaign. New York City started a campaign.
Let's talk about that for a minute. You know, soda at that time was about 3%, actually less, about 2.5% of our calories per capita. All of a sudden, you know, what was a soda when we were kids? 6 ounces, 12 ounces maybe. All of a sudden in the 80s, supersizing, there are big gulps, 34 ounces, bigger gulps, 64 ounces. And just calorically sweetened soda becomes at least 7% of the average calories that people are taking in. That alone is a major impact on the obesity problem in this country.
Well, Mayor Bloomberg and his staff have been in the health staff. Have been trying to approach this with school children, particularly, but everyone in the obesity epidemic. And there is, for those who maybe haven't heard about it yet or don't live in the New York City area, they have had a couple of public service videos out there, and a new one was just launched, and it shows this young man sitting at a counter opening up packets of sugar and downing 16, 18, whatever it is, I'm not sure how many packets of sugar that you find, you know, on the counter of the diner. And people are looking at him in disgust when then he turns and actually there is that much, if not more, in these glasses of soda that they're sugared soda that they're drinking.
Yes. I mean, if we could just
pouring on the fat, that's what they call it, pouring on.
Yes. I mean, it's empty calories, has no nutritive value. You may have seen in the paper, Bloomberg and Patterson are trying to have food stamps not be able to buy
purchase soda.
Right. Well, that's a great idea.
Yeah. I mean, we can't police what people eat.
Well,
really.
they certainly can buy soda without food stamps. But
foods,
if
we're going
to buy soda, they'll buy some vegetables or fruits.
Exactly.
Or a better food.
Right. Let's subsidize good nutrition.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, you wrote something very interesting, and that is about the calorie that everyone just assumes calories were always known and calorie values were known for food, but this is something that came quite late.
Yeah, it did. I mean, they began to be quantified in Germany, what they call the father of dietetics, a man named von Voigt. And our own Wilbur Olin Atwater, the first head of the USDA and a chemist at Wesleyan University, he visited Voigt and other people in Germany. He saw what they were doing. And he came back to America, and he got a grant for $10,000. Now, this is a tremendous amount of money. The average worker made about $500 a year.
Hmm.
This is in 1894. He got this grant, $10,000, and he built, along with a physicist, a calorimeter. He measured calories. He knew that carbohydrates and protein had 4 calories per gram. He knew that fat had 9. That had been established.
Mm-hmm.
But what he did was measure the calories in just about every common food that we consumed. A lot easier than the now. No processed foods. He's just worried about a carrot and a piece of beef, you know. But he did this. And he printed them all in Farmer's Bulletin number 23. What a boring title for something that had probably more impact on the way we ate in America for the next 100 years than anything else. Suddenly, all of the calories were listed in this booklet. And this wasn't all Atwater did. It was thought that alcohol had no calories.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he measured alcohol. He said, oops,
yeah.
7 calories a gram. So maybe we should watch that a little bit. And also, people said, well, you know, calories aren't calories and they're all different. He hooked people up to bicycles on his calorimeter and the respirator. And he fed them, great athletes, all fat diet or all carbohydrate diet. And what did he find out? They expended exactly the same amount of energy. That's what calories are, right. Energy. Whether they were having fat or whether they were having carbohydrates. He actually ended that whole debate before the turn of the 20th century.
Before all these fad diets even developed.
It's been going on forever, you know, because a lot of pseudoscience was going on there too. And reverentially, the pseudoscience will be, you know, referred to if someone says, oh, only carbs or, oh, only fat.
Right.
But the truth is, a calorie is a calorie.
Is a calorie. Yeah. Actually, that's always been my mantra.
Yeah, right.
Count the calories, right. So $55 billion. Oh, coming into that, so you make me think right away, you're talking about calories, a calorie, all of these fad diets, who amongst all the big fads was the biggest in terms of moneymakers?
Well, in terms of moneymakers, now let's put aside here, probably the biggest moneymaker is Weight Watchers.
Wait, well, because it's ongoing
but,
and has been for a long time.
That's ongoing. Right? It's a franchise. It gives pretty good information. If people need support, Weight Watchers is a good place to go.
Right.
So is Tops. That's Take Off Pounds Sensibly. And so is Overeaters Anonymous. I mean, these are all places that give good support. And actually, Tops and OA are nonprofits. Weight Watchers, you do pay, but it's not much of a fee. But let's talk about people who have made a really lot of money. Well, we can talk about the over-the-counter amphetamines, speed,
right.
Things that speed up your metabolism. There's a lot of money to be made there.
SlimFast started out, I think, to be, they had to go back to the FDA and change their
But that's a product. Liquid crash. There was a lot of money to be made there, too. Metrical was the first one in the 60s. The huge money probably goes to low carb, I would think, overall. Atkins being the king of low carb.
Atkins, the one, of course, that we most remember.
Yeah. But this started, the first low carb diet came along in the 1880s when a man, Wilhelm Epstein, a scientist in Germany, he was theorizing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Atwater didn't even have his booklet yet, and not much was known. He was theorizing that fat and carbs burn differently. He thought that only fat got used as energy, only carbs got stored as fat. He knew that fat had more than twice the calories per gram or pound than carbohydrate. And so much of this, I should mention, Linda, all of this research had nothing to do with weight loss. No one gave that a thought, these scientists.
Mm-hmm.
They were mainly concerned with feeding people in the best possible way, particularly the poor.
Mm-hmm.
And Epstein was the director of the poor house in his town in Germany. So he loved fat. You know, he thought the more fat they can eat, the more calories they get. It's cheap. Nothing was known about vitamins or anything
right.
else. So he theorized this. This is still referred to by the low-carb people. Well, Dr. Epstein says, you know, fat gets burned off. You know, you can't get fat with fat. So what happens in the 1960s? Publishing companies began to think there's a lot of money to be made in weight loss books. And along comes a guy, Herman Thaler, a Romanian gynecologist, who publishes a book, Calories Don't Count. 5,000 calories a day, as long as you drink a glass of safflower oil with every meal and don't eat carbohydrates.
Did he include the calories in the safflower oil in the 5,000?
No, he didn't. He didn't, because he said probably most people won't want to drink safflower oil. But wait, you can buy them from me through the mail. CDC Corporation, safflower oil pills. He and Simon Schuster, two executives, started this corporation. They sold the pills through the mail, and that was their Achilles heel. That was their downfall. He was actually indicted and convicted of mail fraud. People knew this diet was crazy.
Yeah.
But, you know, we have freedom of speech. You can write whatever you want to write in America. You know, you can publish fad diet books and not get into
That's
trouble.
Right. Well,
what you can't do is send the stuff through
right.
the mail.
There are a lot of other fad diets that took place, no matter, and we're going to talk about more of those when we come back after a short break. We're back on A Taste of the Past with Susan Yeager, and we're talking about the 100-year diet. Probably, as we said, dieting has been going on for a lot longer than 100 years, but our country is just obsessed with diets, different diets, and yet we remain to be the leading nation in obesity. Right? We were talking about some of the dangerous things that were being sold and things that were, and fad diets that are. I guess not weight loss diets whatsoever, and a lot of fads have come and gone. Some of them were actually healthy diets, you know, such as South Beach diet, which is still active. It's actually a healthy eating plan.
It is certainly an improvement. Mm-hmm. It's kind of an Atkins light. Mm-hmm. The terrible thing about the Atkins diet and some of the other low carb plans was that they put vegetables and fruits
off the list.
All carbohydrates.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Atkins did not allow fruits and vegetables.
They didn't differentiate between complex carbohydrates
and
simple
carbohydrates. And that's one thing. And then they said no carbohydrates, you know, zero carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. At least South Beach does allow for fruits and vegetables and whole grains. I myself have nothing against white foods.
The white food diet.
Bread. Right. These are the staples of so many cultures. My goodness, all you have to do is look at the Asian cultures that are very often rice-based diets. These are the thinnest countries in the world.
Well, in fact, I wanted to bring up a point about the Asian diet. Two of my friends, one who's been on the show and another one I was just talking to the other day, both Asian, and come from, when they sit down with their family, their traditional Asian family, you know, the grandmothers, and they said, it's incredible. We eat and think about food, although we don't eat all the time, but we think about food all the time. And while we're eating our lunch, we're talking about what we're going to have for dinner. She said, we talk about food all the time. And the one woman whose brother-in-law is not Asian said, I cannot believe that your family is not all obese, because all you do is talk about food and plan your meals. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because they do talk about it and they plan it carefully,
right?
But they're not eating all the time.
There are two factors here. One is the, at least in the Japanese culture, there is, and many Chinese people that I know as well, and I've spent a lot of time in China, there is a reverence for food. It's a respect for food. And that's a big part of it. And that's something that I hope we get back mm-hmm. in our country. And also, of course, the Asian diets do tend to be, because they are low fat. They don't use a lot of fat in their diet. They don't use a lot of animal protein. It's more a condiment, a spice, than it is, you know, the big center mm-hmm. of the plate. And those are the things that help in controlling weight. There is almost no obesity in Japan, Korea, the various Asian cultures.
Yeah, interesting. And, of course, there it's interesting
too. May I interject,
yeah, sure.
Though? There's also very little obesity. The latest OECD Factbook figures just came out 2 weeks ago. very little in, let's say, Italy, France. Mm-hmm. These are countries also that revere
food.
They respect it.
Quality. I've said often on many of my shows that figures state that America as a country spends less per capita on their market basket than any mm-hmm. other than yeah. any other yes. civilized country. You know,
I speak about first that world in the book. Country. We actually spent a lot more at the turn of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. About 50% of income went for food, but again, as things were subsidized, corn and soy subsidies lead to not only the high fructose corn sugar that we spoke of earlier, but of course to fattening beef and other animal foods, shooting them with mm-hmm. hormones and antibiotics. They're not something that we should be eating,
right.
but nevertheless, they're very, very inexpensive.
So let's hear it for sustainably raised products.
Indeed.
I mean, or the organic movement is good. I mean, but just, you don't have to go organic. So just, you know, good, whole, real food that
and
you know where it comes from.
We're lucky in New York City. We have so many, and the area, we have so many farmers markets mm-hmm. available now all over.
And I think that that's a growing trend in most cities. And
yes,
and certainly anyone who's ever gardened, I mean, when you finally get that pepper or that ear of corn, I mean, it's very special. You respect it, and you taste it differently. So if you really, that once again, that reverence for food, if you really appreciate what the product is and taste it, not just try to eat, you know, so much of the processed food that really is not satisfying. You have to eat twice as much.
Well, you know? I would be happy if people did not ever eat processed food, you know, period. Never. I think that's a big part of the solution.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting too. Aside from being big industry, as you say, the corn, coming with the corn syrup and the soy products and things that were developed to increase shelf life, increase production, make, you know, things grew faster and bigger and better. They were also, a lot of processed foods were developed to make the woman's life easier in the kitchen.
Oh, yes, of course. Women were sold on that as well. And indeed, as they went back to the workforce, they did start to cook less. And that's another part of the puzzle. We have got to start cooking again.
Right.
We have got to start teaching it in our schools. If people don't know how to cook, how can they ever really nourish themselves and feed themselves? Well, it's not possible. But, you know, right now, we are producing per capita, I'm not saying eating, but producing 700 more calories a day than we need.
Mm.
Now, what's big food going to do with this? Feed it to us. What
right.
else can they do with it? Retail space has doubled since 1995. One of the reasons is, I mean, you can't go into a mass merchant anymore without finding a supermarket. I can't go into a local drugstore without finding a supermarket
anymore. That's
right. Anymore.
That's right. They've got their whole food section on one aisle.
Got to sell it to us.
Yeah.
Got to get rid of those 700 calories a day.
That's right.
We've got to say, no, we don't want them.
And the sad fact is, too, is that we have still a very high hungry population. People who aren't getting enough to eat. And that's inexcusable.
Yes, it is. Yes, it certainly is.
I wish we could solve all of those problems. You did talk. We talked about the Asian population, but also and Italy and France and European countries who appreciate good food, quality ingredients. If you taste, you have to eat a lot less of a very high quality ingredient to be satisfied. The other point I think is sitting down at a meal together, and that's something that has fallen apart in this country. Was it Escoffier or one of the, and you mentioned it in your book as well, mm-hmm. said if you can tell a lot about a civilization if you sit down to dinner with them. Well, kind of hard to do in America.
Yeah, and that is unfortunate.
Yeah.
And that has been happening more and more over the past decades. And it's a big part of it. You know, grabbing a high-calorie, you know, microwave meal isn't going to help anybody. It's not going to help your health. It's not going to help the way you feel. It's not going to help anything.
And well, then that's led to this epidemic in obesity has led to horrendous health problems and an increase in the healthcare costs for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Diabetes being number one, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, one of the things as I wrote this book that I came to really dislike about all of these fad diets the most is that, firstly, they're all the same. People say to me, well, does any diet work, Susan? You write this book, all you say is don't diet, don't diet. And the truth is, they all do, because they're all just low-calorie plans masquerading as something else, and no one can stick to them. It's not possible. Who wants to live a life without pasta, without rice, without bread, or without fat, for that matter? It's not the Western way of eating. We like sautéing things in some olive oil. We like dressing on our salad. You know,
that's not a bad thing.
And it's a good thing.
Yeah.
But what I dislike so much about these diets is that people try them and they fail because they have to. No one's going to stay with it. And, you know, it's not like I've never dieted. Believe me, I've been on my share of loopy diets too. And then, you know, you fail. And then you beat yourself up. And then you try again. And then you fail again. And eventually, what can happen? Apathy can set in. And I've had friends say to me, that's it. Life is too short. I'm going to eat what I want.
Right.
They just give up. And I really believe that this love affair with weight loss diets has helped get us to where we are, as much as the high fructose corn syrup and the palm oil and the processed foods and everything else. It's another piece of an unfortunate puzzle that has to be solved.
Well, it's not yo-yo dieting so much as it is just with this exponential, as you mentioned, exponential, you know, weight gain. Mm-hmm. Lose it and gain a little bit more.
Yes.
Gain it back and then some.
Yeah.
Although I do agree with some of the dieting theories that you kind of have to jumpstart a diet. Diet is what we eat, which should be a healthy diet, and that should be a life plan diet, right?
Exactly.
But certainly if one is obese or severely overweight, I mean, you have to jumpstart a healthy diet plan. In other words, you're eating too much of something. You've got to cut out something that you're consuming.
Sure.
And then adopt a reasonable, healthy life plan and diet plan and eat good foods.
But I think we're speaking of two different things in a sense, in that if one is, as you say, severely obese or morbidly obese, there may be psychological reasons for this.
Mm-hmm.
There may be genetic reasons for this. There may be hormonal. There are certain triggers. It's a very small part of the population, but some people store weight differently than the rest of us, and some people have psychological reasons for not wanting to be thin. So many different things that a morbidly obese person really has to seriously deal with, perhaps a psychologist, perhaps a nutritionist, perhaps a physician. This isn't someone that just, you know, needs to lose 20 pounds or 30 pounds.
Right.
Very different situation.
But people do have to look very honestly at their daily diet and figure out, well, why? Why did I gain this? What am I eating? What does my diet consist
of? Well, of course, if we're eating even a portion of that 700 extra calories every day, say 400 of them or 500 of them, which we probably are per capita, or we couldn't be, you know, that's how we've gotten from 1985 to today to be in this position. I mean, in 1980, about 25% of the country or so was obese or overweight. Now it's almost 70%.
That's
takes a lot of
remarkable
calories to do that.
Indeed.
Not just an extra teaspoon of sugar.
Well, before the show, you were telling me about a course that you teach at the Food Studies program at NYU, and it's a course on sustainability.
Yes, I actually co-teach this course. Another instructor and myself lead a group of graduate students every year. We just did it last weekend for the third year in a row through the east end of Long Island. I have a home actually on Shelter Island. I've been there since 1993 on weekends. And we go to various wonderful local farmers, aquaculture, agriculture people, and see, oh my goodness, there's a biodynamic woman, KK Haspel, on the North Fork. She has 5 acres of land. I can't, and produces flowers on one of the acres. So on 4 acres of land, she produces more food than you could ever possibly imagine. And it is so beautiful and so delicious. People of that sort, you know, seeing what people are doing out there, people making cheese, a few cows, they all have names, you know, wonderful, milk them by hand and make wonderful cheeses. There are wonderful things going on right around us, you know, within 100 miles of where we are. And it's heartfelt. And some people have been farming this way, by the way, out on the East End for 350 or 400 years. Well, so you talk about sustainable.
Exactly. And it's funny that we have come kind of full circle, because as I've said before, that was the only way to eat. You know, hundreds of years ago, you ate what the farmer produced, or you ate locally and you ate seasonally, and you ate what was grown.
Right. And until after the Second World War, when so much was learned about chemicals and pesticides, and, you know, let's not forget, they thought they were doing the right thing by spraying with DDT. They thought this was a good thing to do. And there were people that said, wait a minute, maybe we should test more. But, you know, but they thought this was the right thing to do. Well, before that, there were no hormones in food. There were no antibiotics in meat. Vegetables weren't sprayed. Mm-hmm. It didn't exist.
We like it all to look uniform and be packaged, you know, perfectly.
That's right. Not that beauty of a heritage piece of fruit or a heritage tomato. You know, I think the beauty kind of lies in the not perfect myself.
Ugly but beautiful.
Yeah.
The unevenness and the non-perfect.
Right? I think that's so beautiful.
Yeah. Well, I know that you are going to be, I saw it in one of the blurbs about your book, that you are going to be speaking about your book and the preoccupation with weight at the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America.
Yes, on October 19th, the very nice Dooley lecture series that they have there. October 19th, I believe it's at 2 o'clock. This is a free series that CIA does, and it's beautiful up there. For anyone who hasn't been up to the Culinary Institute, it is a beautiful campus.
Well, and again, it's the 100-year diet, America's voracious appetite for losing weight. And I thank our guest, Susan Yeager, for enlightening us on the history of dieting. We can, if you look at the book, you can find out how many diets, and I'm sure many of us have been on many of them, but it's been going on for years and years, and hopefully we can turn that around and have everyone eat good food.
Right? Let's hope. That's why I wrote the book. Thank you, Linda.
Well, I'm Linda Pelaccio, and you've been listening to A Taste of the Past. I would like to thank our executive producer, Jack Inslee, and the engineer, Nat Wiener.
For appearing on A Taste of the Past today, Susan receives a free 365-day gift card, complimentary of Zagat.com. Use this 365-day Zagat.com gift card to enjoy trusted Zagat ratings and reviews derived from the opinions of 375,000 surveyors across the globe, all conveniently located in one place. For more information, visit www.zagat.com. Thanks for listening.